Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say!
Welcome back to another edition of the Internet's most dangerous Tottenham Hotspur podcast. It's Wheeler Dealer Radio. I'm your host, Greg, and we have the OG crew with us today. Everybody's here after our little international break. I feel like it's been 3 months or something since Spurs have played a match, but we're here to talk about Tottenham anyway, to A, get you ready for the weekend, but more importantly, B, to talk about a important figure in this podcast history, Andre Villas-Boas. We're going to have a look back in anger today. But first, let's introduce all of our experts leading us off, joining us from the depths of Patreon. It's Michael Cayley. Michael, welcome back.
It's good to be back. Hi.
Glad you're bringing your A game for this one.
He's used to doing the intros by himself.
Next up, we have my sidekick, Ben Daniels. Ben, are you ready to look back at the handsomest era of Tottenham Hotspur?
I sure am. My favorite manager in Tottenham history.
Says a lot about someone.
I was just realizing that I when I started doing the intros, I just totally copied Greg's inflection.
Nice.
That's how I do Greg voice to introduce my podcast.
See, the influence is widespread. Like Cruyff influencing Barcelona and Manchester City. I'm just, my tentacles reach out across the soccer podcasting world. And finally, we have the longest tenure member of Wheeler Dealer Radio. It's Brian Ashlock. Brian, how's it going?
It's going great. I'm really looking forward to talking about, like you said, the handsomest, and also the guy that looks best in period drama attire.
We'll see how deep we get into Zenit world on this podcast. Brian did a very good job outlining the highs and many, many lows of Andre Villas-Boas for us before we did this podcast. Let's start off. So in 2012, Tottenham Hotspur, after they fired Harry Redknapp, and we'll get into the circumstances in a second, they hired Andre Villas-Boas fresh off his sacking at Chelsea. What was, Ben, I'll start with you. What was your sort of initial reaction to this? How did you, what did you think when Tottenham announced we were hiring AVB?
I was ecstatic. You know, he was a guy who, you know, after the Redknapp years, we were definitely looking for someone with a little continental swagger, someone who could give us more, you know, tactical know-how, someone a little savvier, someone a little better dressed, you know, someone who could take us to that next level.
Someone without Monaco bank accounts.
Right. Just Monaco bankrolling his Dakar rally dreams. fucking run around a bit was only going to take us so far. And this was a guy who had come off of an invincible season at Porto. He'd won the Europa League. Chelsea saw him as the heir to Jose Mourinho, even though they could not be more different.
I don't know. They're not that different.
Not anymore.
Charming and handsome and how dare you. we saw his failure at Chelsea as kind of like Chelsea's fault. You know, he was tasked with getting rid of the old guard of the John Terrys and the Didier Drogbas and building a new look side for the future. He didn't have the money. He didn't have, you know, Roman's backing in the dressing room when it came to those big ego fights, and it went really badly. And so for Spurs, this was like a huge coup to get this guy who, you know, only wasn't at a mega club because that mega club was stupid.
Well, I want to talk about that for a second, Ben. And Brian, I'm interested in what you think of this, because, you know, before Redknapp sort of took Spurs to Champions League and a couple years of very barely missing out on the Champions League, like, Tottenham had sort of stabilized themselves as a regular Europa League club, the kind of club that gets out of the group stages of the Europa League. But I don't think there was a lot separating sort of where Tottenham were, at least at the time, in retrospect, I think we could see the differences from where a team like, say, Everton were, or where a team a few years from then, like Southampton were. But like these teams that just sort of habitually hung around outside of the Champions League and kind of hope to sneak in every few years. I think Redknapp and Gareth Bale, to an extent, sort of, and Modric too, changed sort of a lot of Spurs opinions, of Spurs fans' opinions of where the team was and what they could do. But I think my memory of it is certainly that AVB really signaled, was a sign of intent from the team, that we weren't just going to take a guy like Roberto Martinez, who was a good hand in the Premier League, and we'd see what he could do with us, kind of like we ended up doing with Redknapp. It seemed like, you know, AVB was a real statement of intent from Levy and the club to say, like, we are trying to, we want to be a regular Champions League club, and we want to contend for more than people think we're capable of. And, well, go ahead, Brian. I'm just curious what you think of that.
I mean, you know, kind of the last statement of intent that Spurs had made in that same respect was the hiring of Wandy Ramos, where you had a guy who had been at Sevilla and had won Europa Leagues and had done very well. And, you know, he came in and he won a League Cup for Spurs, and then it all kind of flamed out. And so, yeah, it was a direction change, and it was, you know, I guess we'll talk about, you know, why the Redknapp sacking happened and that sort of stuff in a second. But, you know, it was something that the club didn't need to do. Redknapp was still under contract. He had another year on his deal. You know, we just finished fourth. Chelsea winning the Champions League was the only thing that kept us out of the Champions League for that next season.
Mm-hmm.
We could have very easily kept Redknapp around and gone into the next season. But yeah, it was absolutely a statement of intent. And, you know, the names that we were linked with were all colossally underwhelming. I think even at the time, like, I, you know, looking back at the list of who had been, like, the betting favorites all through, you know, about the month that we had people, it's like, David Moyes, Rafa Benitez, Roberto Martinez, Laurent Blanc, and Jurgen Klinsmann. None of those are, like, I would look back on now and be like, oh, that would have been good. Like, Rafa Benitez, maybe, just because he seems to still be a consistently good manager. But other than that...
But even the bloom had kind of gone off of Rafa's rose by then.
Yeah.
Not to the degree it has by now, but... I mean,
funny thing is that the bloom had gone off of Rafa's rose by then, but looking back now, it's clear that's the one out of those guys
you yes.
would have wanted. Like, and I think it really goes to, as sort of, this is an AVB point, how hard it is to make that leap as a manager.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is, I mean, Martinez was supposed to be the guy, you know, Martinez, people loved Bobby Martinez back then. And Moyes had a fantastic track record. The question was if he could bump it up. Klinsmann had been in charge of that Germany team that was, like, you know, transformative. Like, this is – it's all of those guys looked really good back then.
But this is an interesting – and Blanc hadn't soured everyone with his French team yet.
There's also one other guy who was in the running, but Liverpool saved us from that ever coming.
You're right. I forgot that was a link. Brendan Rodgers.
Brendan Rodgers at Swansea was, you know, very transformative, the very much like the predecessor of Pochettino, you know, doing a lot with very little, putting an attractive style on a team that had no right to be as good as it was.
He would have been a really, in every possible way, he would have been a fitting successor to Redknapp.
Right. Yeah, and then Liverpool just happened to move faster than us.
Well, which is funny because aside from Rodgers, who I think Liverpool had really locked him up during the year, none of these guys, like Spurs, like you said, we fired Redknapp on the 13th. AVB was appointed on the 3rd, and I think he's named a little bit earlier than that. Spurs moved very fast on this. They clearly had been talking to AVB before they made the move to fire Harry. Because I don't, like, those names were. None of those names were as developed as, say, Frank de Boer was a couple years later when we ended up hiring Pochettino. Like it was still very early in the sort of, like, who are we going to get process. And then, like, all of a sudden, AVB came out of nowhere. Before we fully move on to AVB, Michael, I'm curious from your perspective. Redknapp his sort of, I think his reputation has suffered a little bit since he left Spurs. Do you think he, Spurs were, do you think it was the right move, independent of sort of AVB and how that turned out, firing Redknapp at that period of time? Do you think that was the right move?
So my memory is that, like, Redknapp's and Levy's relationship fell apart down the stretch there, where he was, like, angling for the England job.
Yes, you're not.
Checked out.
You're not incorrect.
And so, it seemed, my take on what was happening at the time was that, like, he had basically decided he didn't care. And he managed the team like he didn't care down that stretch. And Levy was, and he was gone.
Well, like, the famous.
I don't remember there being like this decision point. I remember it being sort of like, as that season wore on and Spurs choked away what should have been a pretty nailed on Champions League place, even though they did finish fourth, they should not have been like, they should not have been at risk of being pipped for fourth by Arsenal as they were. And like that all happened because Redknapp stopped caring. And so like, and I just think- thought.
And we lost that the Newcastle match on the last day of the season.
I think also part of it is, you know, with Harry eyeing the England job so publicly, Daniel Levy was already moving to replace him, because even if, you know, the season hadn't gone bad, you know, we were approaching the back half of the season under the assumption that, you know, Harry Redknapp was the heir apparent to that team. It was obvious he was getting that job. And I think, yeah, you know, we had already begun laying groundwork even before that relationship soured. And then, you know, once the England job got pulled away from him, you know, I think we've A, gone too far. I think B, if we had qualified for the Champions League, if Chelsea hadn't won, or if we managed to finish third, I think there's a world where we do the, you know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer move and say, well, you know, dance with the one who brung you.
Oh, I think he was fired. I'm personally of the opinion, this isn't based on anything other than reading tea leaves, I think he was gone no matter what.
I think so too. But I think if we had qualified for the Champions League, it might not have happened. But yeah, his job, I mean, by the end of the season was almost certainly not his anymore. So we got AVB.
So we got AVB, and he was seen as a real coup by Spurs at the time. And a lot of that was because everyone saw him as Mourinho's heir apparent. I mean, he's a good-looking guy out of Portugal, won the league in the Europa League with Porto, went to Chelsea. A lot of people, mostly Spurs fans, sort of talked themselves, like we were saying earlier, out of all the problems he had at Chelsea and just said, oh, well, Chelsea's a rat's nest, and it's a viper pit, and who could have succeeded there, and all this other stuff. Turned out later on, maybe we should have paid more attention, but at the time, we were all very happy with it. AVB came in, and I don't know, I guess this is another thing we should have seen coming. He talked a big game about, you know, attacking and sophisticated football, and it was very defensive, but it wasn't ineffective.
Well, I think before we get to his actual performance, we should deal with that summer, because one of the big thing that happened that summer was the conclusion of the long-running Modric saga. And, you know, we had avoided selling him to Chelsea the year before, but he was all but gone to Real Madrid, and that happened very quickly. And so, you know, our best player, arguably, was now gone, and AVB had some work to do to put this team back together.
But he sort of got some of the players. But he sort of got some of the players that he would need. Like, he got Dembele that summer. He got Vertonghen.
He got Dembele at the deadline.
At the deadline, he scored a goal in his first game against
Norwich?
West Brom. It was West Brom, I think. But Vertonghen, I mean, he got a lot of really key players. He got Adebayor right off of Adebayor having a hot streak the previous year with Spurs. We finalized his transfer. They got Lloris, who he benched for several weeks.
The Brad Friedel, Hugo Lloris 3-month-long thing where they was just like, why are we doing this?
We picked up Vertonghen early that summer.
We did. That was clearly arranged. He was at our last league game, I think.
2 days after we finalized Vyas Boas, I think. Like, Gylfi was the first signing.
And they also got Clint Dempsey, who wasn't a world beater, but played a crucial role and scored some crucial goals that year.
Can we talk about a stupid great summer that is?
That's a really productive summer. Except for the Adebayor thing. That one kind of didn't work out for us. But
that worked out great. We got him on loan.
That was him. Well, I mean, that was him permanently signing.
Yeah, we had him the year before.
City basically paid all his wages, though.
That was pretty good, actually.
And Vertonghen and Dembele and Lloris were all under 20 million, all peak age, and all remained key parts of Spurs for 5 years.
And even Sigurdsson was a contributor, and we got a lot of money for him, or at least we got another player for him at the end. You know, that's a very productive summer. We didn't lose. Look who went out. We got Modric was obviously the big one. We lost Van der Vaart. I think we probably got out a little bit, like, right on time on that one. I mean, Chorluka, who we all missed, but was probably over it. Nielsen, which, Jesus Christ.
But Steven, there's so many of those guys that we lost, or not lost, but that left anyway, were people that I deeply associate with Harry Redknapp era Spurs.
Yes, and a lot of Luka, sort of
Nelson,
loose.
Saha, Gio Dos Santos, Nico Kranjčar, Steven Pienaar, like all those guys. Like, it's just like, that is Harry Redknapp Spurs. And I guess I forgot the level of clearing out that we kind of did that first summer to, you know, where it sort of looked like, oh, okay, we're transitioning away from this, you know, fucking run around a bit, this 4-4-2, big man, little man, you know, that sort of stuff. Like, we're going to do this 4-2-3-1, 4-3-3 thing where Gareth Bale is the focus, and we're going to bring in players that make that work. And so you really kind of felt like Villas-Boas and Levy, and I don't think Baldini had joined at this point. But, you know, you felt like they were moving in a direction that, like, made sense.
So the big transfer that didn't happen on deadline day, and there's some funny stories around this, I don't know how true they are, was Moutinho didn't come to Spurs out of Portugal. Michael, do you think, I mean, this is a big what if in Spurs history. I don't think Moutinho went on to sort of have a fine career, but he never really lit it up or really progressed to the next level. How much of an impact do you think that had on Villas-Boas at Spurs? Because I think there's always been a bit of a bit of bitterness that he never got his guy and that it didn't happen. And, like, there was even a quote from him this week where, like, Moutinho was just convinced that this deal was going to go through, and then at the last minute, you know, it just didn't come off for reasons that may or may not be true. But, I mean, how much do you think not getting Moutinho affected AVB Spurs?
Yeah, because, like, the thing about AV Spurs, and this is sort of, we can go into this as we get into it, that first season, during that period that we were running Sandro Dembele out as a midfield, we had, like, the perfect midfield. And we didn't need Jean Moutinho. Moussa Dembele turned out to be the ideal Modric replacement while being a different player. And I don't know what would have happened with Dembele and Sandro if we also had Moutinho. Would we have just sat Dembele to play to play two in midfield? Would we have pushed Moutinho up? Like, Moutinho is a very good player, and Moutinho right now is, like, old as crap and can't run anymore, and is still a good starting midfielder on the seventh best team in England. Like, he absolutely would have been a good signing. We had identified the right player, but I'm not sure. And the thing I think about is, like, if we had signed Moutinho and then everything else had happened the exact same way and Sandro had gotten hurt, would we not have run that stupid Dembele Parker midfield?
I don't think we would have. I mean, I think there's always been, from AVB's camp and from fans who really support him, there's always been a bit of a, I don't think they've ever come out and say it, but the implicit sort of message is part of the reason that AVB's system largely never felt like it clicked at Spurs was because he didn't get the personnel in to make it work. And I think that's really what they're saying when they say that is, we didn't get Moutinho. And
we didn't get Hulk.
I want to go back on this for a second, because the other thing with AVB that people, I feel like, don't talk about much is how he radically changed the way he approached football tactically after the Chelsea failure.
Yes.
Like, his Chelsea team really was wide open and, like, suicidally attacking at times. Like, they were getting ripped open by through balls. They were getting ripped open on the counterattack because of how far up he was pushing the defenders, how much risk he wanted his midfielders to take, the sorts of the way that they played was complete, and then we came to Spurs, and he wanted to have, you know, he always had two really good ball winners in midfield, and he didn't take risks with the rest of the team. He didn't push his midfielders forward. They didn't, I mean, even Moutinho was not a guy who, like, gets forward into the penalty area that much. Like, he wanted to play a very different, much more defensive, sort of defensive pressing game where the press strangles the opposition much more than it creates lots of fun attacking chances. I don't buy that AVB had a vision for super fun attacking football that he was unable to express at Spurs. I think that he changed that whole idea because it failed at Chelsea, and the rest of his career he's been playing out that defensive pressing string. That's what he did at Zenit too.
I mean,
that's how he's approaching the Dakar rally.
If he really did learn from Mourinho, that certainly fits his career arc as well. Do you think some of the way, like, that sort of defensive approach came out of him realizing, oh shit, I have Gareth Bale. Like, Gareth Bale's going to be able to get up the field really quick, and we're going to be able to counterattack like hell and transition really fast. Do you think some of it was down to that? Because I think unquestionably the biggest success that AVB had at Spurs was, and we can get into how much he had to do with this, but overseeing Gareth Bale becoming a world-class player.
Well, and I mean, I guess we can talk about this kind of later in the, and when we talk about, you know, well, I guess, no, this is the best point, because this season is like, it felt like so much of our offense was just Gareth Bale.
By the end of the season, it was. It was Gareth Bale and Clint Dempsey cleaning up his messes in the box. Like, that was our offense.
It was the Tom Carroll assist to Gareth Bale to win matches. It was, you know, it was just like everybody giving him the ball and being like, all right, now what? You know, and Bale was our leading scorer, and it just felt like nobody else really had any ideas in terms of what to do in the attack. And if you look at, like, our scoring charts for the season, like, Bale is the leading scorer, and next is, like, Defoe, who had, like, 10 or 12 goals, and then it's, you know, Vertonghen has, like, 6 goals, and he's, like, the 5th or 6th leading scorer on the team.
I think the thing, though, is when we're talking about, like, how he set up his team. Like, Gareth Bale, before AVB, you know, he had scored 9 goals the year before, 7 goals the year before that. Like, he was a solid goal-scoring winger. He was not a guy who you build your attack around. Like, he was great, and we all loved him. You know, he'd had that wonderful Champions League against Inter, you know, a couple of years earlier. But, you know, he was not a world-beating star. And so for ABB to identify him as obviously our key attacker, when we had, you know, Adebayor, who had scored 18 goals the year before, you know, Jermaine Defoe, who was always a, you know, a reliable scorer, you know, and he really centered that team around a guy who had never outscored either of those two guys. And he deserves a lot of credit for that, obviously.
How much, Ben, how much do you think Bale's sort of, and if let's how did Gareth Bale change that year, and how much of it do you think was down to AVB?
I mean, he changed dramatically because, you know, when we played under Harry Redknapp, Gareth Bale was a left winger, Aaron Lennon was a right winger. You know, we played 2 up top, and that was our team. And, you know, I know we had tons of arguments over where Bale's best position was because, you know, he was playing him through the middle, he was playing him on the right, he was giving him a lot of opportunities to cut inside and drive towards goal and score in a way that he'd never had that freedom before. You know, and so I think by allowing Gareth Bale to do whatever Gareth Bale wanted, I mean, that was huge. And I don't know that Gareth Bale would have made that leap if he was stuck being a traditional Premier League left winger forever.
So here's my question. If you see Bale having that kind of transformation, taking that kind of step, and I think that's something AVB very much saw happening and changed the way he was working things to suit it. Do you think this would have happened under any manager, or do you think it was really a result of some, like, AVB really seeing something there and doing it and doing something to really accommodate it?
It's hard to say. This is one of those things we've argued about with a lot of players over the years. You know, did Harry Redknapp make Luka Modric by turning him into a central midfielder, or would anybody have figured out that that was his natural evolution? You know, would Harry Kane have gotten a chance under anyone but Tim Sherwood? You know, it's hard to, you know, rewrite history that way. And I think it's certainly possible that someone would have identified, you know, Bale as a possible Ronaldo imitator. But Anthony's the guy who did it, and that's where the credit does, you know, belongs.
So, looking at the season as a whole, I mean, you know, we did have a record point total. We got 72, which is the most we'd ever gotten before, but we finished fifth. We went out in the fourth round of both domestic cups. We got eliminated in the Europa League quarterfinals by Basel. I mean, this was, especially compared to the previous years where we barely missed out on the Champions League. We weren't far out, but we weren't like a razor-thin margin that year. This is kind of a disappointing year on results, and yet I think Spurs fans, maybe it's because of the emergence of Bale, maybe it's because AVB was so sort of performative or, you know, demonstrably excited about things. It felt, in retrospect, it feels all very calculated to me, but at the time I certainly bought into it. Spurs were feeling pretty good about the future. Spurs fans, I feel like, were feeling pretty good about the future of the team. Right, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, well,
go ahead, Ben.
You're not Brian.
I know, but before you like poo-poo this season and undersell it, we finished with a record point total of 72 points. We were 1 point behind Arsenal, who had 73. We were 3 points behind Chelsea, who had 75, and 6 points behind Man City, who had 78. Like, we were right in the thick of it. Like, we had a very good season. Like, yes, it ended up we finished fifth, but, you know, I think there was a lot of reasons on the table to be very excited about what this team looked like.
I mean, and I do think, and Brian, I'll kick it over to you in a second, but
sorry, Brian.
I do think there's like a lot of the problems with that team are much more evident in retrospect, especially knowing that we're about to lose Bale and he was the center of anything we did that resulted in scoring a goal. You know, a lot of those things are, you know, sort of the performativeness of his sideline behavior. A lot of the problems that we had with AVB later on are much more evident in retrospect than they were at the time. But I still think, like, Spurs fans, my memory at least, Brian, was that Spurs fans were feeling really good at the end of this season. And considering, you know, how angry we were at the end of, say, like, Redknapp's last season, which on paper looks pretty good. And obviously there's a narrative there that explains that, what we talked about. But why were Spurs fans, I guess, so happy at the end of this year? How are we feeling about AVB after year one?
Well, if I'd been allowed to talk about 3 minutes later, I would have said all those things that Ben said. And then, you know, I also would have added that, you know, this was no team in Premier League history or probably English top flight history had finished with 72 points had never not made the Champions League. So, I mean, we just ran into a season where the top four was very good. We were also very good. And we had just, you know, somehow managed to finish fifth because Arsenal were at that point continually predestined to finish above us. You know, so yeah, I think we felt good with the proviso that I think we all kind of understood that Gareth Bale was leaving.
Oh, I don't, I disagree. I think we all thought we had one more year of Bale. I don't think we realized how hard,
maybe this is me looking back now with the benefit of hindsight, but I think that, you know, 2013 me felt like he was gone. But, I think
that Gareth Bale billboard went up in Times Square.
Yeah.
I was certain.
I took a picture in front of that.
Oh, that's right. The billboard. Because, I mean, you know, and I guess we'd kind of been given false hope sort of by the Modric saga where, you know, we'd convinced Modric to stay one more year and give us one more shot. And maybe we thought Bale was going to do that. But, yeah, I think there were a lot of reasons to be hopeful because you could see that, you know, AVB was transitioning us from what we had been under Redknapp. And he was transitioning to us in this team that had this high defensive line and that, you know, we played in a style that was kind of consistent with some of the people that we thought of as being continental and modern and tactical and all these things that Redknapp had not been. And, you know, and we had Lewis Holtby to be excited about. Ugh. And, you know, we had so much stuff going for us. We had a midfield in Dembele and Sandro that a lot of Spurs fans felt was probably the best midfield in the league, and we had won at Old Trafford for like the first time in 23 years, and we have, you know, AVB spiking his jacket on the ground on the sideline, and like, you know, like there was just so much excitement around the club, and a lot of it was generated, you know, by AVB himself, because he, if nothing else, AVB has always been a relentless self-promoter, and he until kind of the end at Spurs, he always seemed to talk a good game, and he was so handsome and dreamy, and you just kind of hung on every word, and he said all the right things about how to play football and the things he wanted to do and the players he wanted to bring in and what do you know every it was kind of the precursor to the cult of Pochettino that we have now, except, you know, it all kind of soured at the end.
Because in a lot of ways, like AVB, the idea of AVB was very much what Spurs wanted, and AVB was also a bit smarter than Mourinho in terms of his self-promotion, in that he did a better job, or I don't know about smarter, but he certainly did a better job of keeping fans on side with him, because he did that We Is Us stuff. He had, you know, I mean, lots of just stuff that really fired up the fan base, and I was one of them. But, I mean, Michael, you look back at this period in time, and I know it's kind of hard to discount what we know now, but, I mean, were you concerned at all in retrospect about, like, I don't know, how we looked going forward? Because I know my sort of, I was able to sort of hand wave away any sort of, you know, offensive issues we had with, like, oh, look, we had this one player, Gareth Bale, who became this offensive superstar this year, and, you know, he just, AVB was riding the wave, and next year he'll figure out a way to sort of build a system around that and get a little bit more out of the rest of the team and, you know, really leverage Gareth Bale in a way that'll help things. And, you know, I just sort of talked myself into that, when in retrospect you can see it, whether or not he developed Bale into that, he had no plans of how to complement that.
I mean, we were also, sorry to interrupt, Michael, but we were also in like year 10 of hashtag we need a striker.
True.
Like, you know, like we'd signed Adebayor and we thought like that would be good, and then it wasn't. And so, like, you know, there was still that hope that all we're doing is we're missing an elite number 9 and that'll be it. We'll be fine.
I mean, I just don't think that, like, I have a different narrative of how AVB failed at Spurs, like, because when we fell, like, the team fall apart because the attack didn't work. Like, AVB failed when the defense fell apart. What AVB was at Spurs was a very effective and successful defense first manager. And we were a really – we were one of – we conceded, like, more goals than we should have. Our expected goals were elite that first season under AVB. And, I mean, I thought we had going forward, like, we had – we would score enough goals and we would defend like the Dickens. And we had, like, this press that squeezed all the smaller teams we played against, and they could get nothing against us. We were never conceding any shots. And our defensive press, like – was kind of boring, was kind of frustrating to watch, and having Bale, like, save that a few times. But fundamentally, like, that was the team that we were, and I thought that was going to be a successful team. And I don't think that we were necessarily wrong about that. AVB just, like, quit on it himself. And that's where we fell apart the next year.
Well, and you look at a great example of your point is that Old Trafford win, which I thought was the most exciting fucking thing I've ever seen when I was watching it live. But that was a real...
Oh, my God, that was amazing.
It was, because we scored these...
Remember Gareth Bale jumping into his arms, like...
Oh, against West Ham? Yeah, and it was,
that
like...
That was magical.
And that's the stuff, like, that really sold you on AVB. Like, the way he celebrated with the players. I mean, and some of it was him riding that lightning of Gareth Bale, because in that, you know, in that United game, it was like, we scored these two ridiculous goals early on. We just packed it in and held on for the rest of the half and still conceded a bit. And then we scored that goal at the beginning of the second half. And then we just held on for dear life. And like you said, Michael, I think that's something that, because it worked out in a weird way, I think we sort of forget how good a defensive manager he was. And, you know, I think long-term that lack of attack would have been a problem, but you're right. The defense would fall apart. Are there any other, I mean, there were some highlights to that first year. I don't want to sort of glide past them. United win, I mean, that West Ham game, I think, was sort of the apex of Gareth Bale at Spurs. Are there any other big moments that you think are worth, you know, remembering? Because I think we're about to run out of good memories real fast here.
We're not going to talk about the Tom Carroll's, ascendancy?
Sure. Penn, I'll leave that one to you.
We also have, we had the draw against Man U at home where Clint Dempsey scored that garbage goal in, stoppage time. We beat Arsenal 2-1 at home with those great goals from Bale and Lennon, both of them running onto through balls.
That game was really fun, where they rounded the keeper.
That game was amazing.
They both rounded the keeper.
In the Europa League, we had Gareth Bale scoring that, last-minute free kick against Lyon. There was a lot of highlights.
And the game that we don't remember as clearly, but was really important. Remember we beat City down the stretch?
That where we scored three goals in 6 minutes. We scored three goals in 6 minutes. That was ridiculous.
Oh, the Tom Huddleston game.
It was actually a garbage game. It was a garbage game, but we threw it together for about 10 minutes there, and it worked really well.
We destroyed them in the second half. It was like AVB made a tactical switch, and it was fantastic. And if we had just got – we drew against Wigan. If we'd beaten Wigan
– in a game where Bale karate kicked the ball in, a clearance into the net, we still somehow lost that game.
We finished fourth. He doesn't karate kick a clearance into the net. We finished fourth.
Well, he does, and then we couldn't do anything else. That's how we scored our one goal. But
all right, that was but we could have been just slightly better in that game, slightly lucky. The thing about that season is that we were probably the fourth best team in the league, and Liverpool was actually fantastic that year, which is one of the weirdest things that happened ever. But besides that, they if you check it out, they had the third best goal difference in the league. They were really good, but we easily could have been fourth and would have deserved it. I don't know. It seems obvious to me to be happy about that.
Goal difference ahead of us.
They were slightly behind. Oh yeah, that's right. Their goal difference was good enough to be in the hunt, and then they, while at the same time they were significantly underplaying their expected goals that year.
Yeah, we were very good that year, and if things broke a little bit differently, we would have made the Champions League, and maybe we would have kept Gareth Bale.
Yeah, if Holtby had played one more good game. More than one good game, rather.
Any good game.
Yeah, aside from that one Norwich game. I think that was a big, I think there's a lot that went on that second summer that really affected Pochettino, or that really affected AVB, which was, we sold Bale, and I think we didn't plan on selling Bale, and I think we quoted an insane number to Real Madrid, and we ended up getting there, and that's why we sold him. And we brought in all these players, and I think some of them were were AVB's first choice. Paulinho, I think, was definitely AVB buy. I don't think Eriksen was. Lamela certainly wasn't. I don't know about Soldado. I don't know if Soldado was or not, but AVB didn't seem, in retrospect, on board with a lot of these guys. And I think any manager would have had trouble rejiggering the team around them, but I think that's where the problem started.
It certainly was because, again, you had an ultra-defensive top side relying on, a mega-talent to carry the attack. We thought Lamela was going to, replace Bale's goals. We thought Soldado was going to be that 20-goal striker, and neither of them were. So we weren't able to eke out wins the same way or, beat teams the same way we did. But, the climate at the time of that summer, and yes, this may have been just sort of really sad rationalization, but
media
was, we sold Elvis and bought the Beatles.
I think that was the mood among Spurs fans. I think the media was a lot more skeptical.
They weren't. That was the media headline, was they sold Elvis and bought the Beatles. We didn't make that up. That was what was in the papers. Everyone was like, this is how you replace a star. Look at this. We have got a starting midfielder for Brazil's national team. We have a guy who scored 20 goals a year for the past 8 years. We have Christian Eriksen, this hot young talent that, somehow nobody bought earlier. We have the highest scoring winger from Serie A, who's only 21. We bought all of these guys who looked like they should have been really great talents. In hindsight, replacing a star is very hard, and it would have taken everybody to have sort of hit the ground running and done exactly what we predicted them to or hoped them to do for it to work out. But, you know, I think the mood around the club was still very positive after selling Gareth Bale.
Well, I think in hindsight, even if you look at those guys, like, that we didn't do bad. Like, you know, Paulinho didn't work out in terms of, you know, what his actual production was here, but he's obviously still, he is a good player, and we ended up selling him for a profit. Eriksen and Lamela have been, you know, mainstays here. Soldado is probably the one that you look at the most and it's like, okay, that wasn't worth what we paid for him. But everything else...
Chadley was productive. We all got frustrated with him, but he scored a lot of goals for Spurs.
I mean, he scored enough, and his price was such that it was fine. I think Capu is probably the most disappointing one because you can look at him...
No, Paulinho is the most disappointing one. Like, that's the most disappointing one. We should have spent that much money on that dude.
Yeah, but
I think Capu, I think, weirdly enough, was the most crucial piece to this super defensive system that ABB had, like that Michael's talking about, you know, with Sandro being irrevocably broken the season before, Scott Parker being old and bad, you know, getting a defensive midfielder like Capu into the team working immediately might have changed things. You know, that might have held the side together,
and I think
in a way that wouldn't have precipitated that defensive collapse.
And what sucks is Capu is capable of playing that well, just not with any sort of consistency. And we all think it's because of off the field issues, but who the hell knows?
I mean, but what happens that season if we just like don't shoot terribly? Like, think about Paulinho. Paulinho underperformed expected goals by, I believe, more than anyone else in the Premier League that year. And in his
Soldado or Paulinho?
Paulinho.
Well, but I think one of the things, and you know,
remember
Michael wrote a ton about this at the time, is that, you know, is it while we were underperforming, like, you know, Paulinho had like, I don't know, one goal in from 38 shots or something like that, and Townsend was similarly bad, like two goals from 40 something shots. But like what we were doing, and again this is something that Michael wrote about, is we were taking horrendously bad shots. Like this was the era of Spurs not getting into the danger zone. This was the era of 35 yard pot shots and, you know, Andros Townsend cutting inside and just blasting over the bar from about 30 yards out. Like, that was our offense. And you know, finishing luck aside, like, that wasn't a sustainable attack.
Michael, do your numbers remember a different story?
I mean, our shot, we were taking tons and tons of shots from not good areas, but we were also missing good chances from, it was both. Like, we were getting, because the defensive press was still working. The Capu addition did exactly what it was supposed to do to keep, so we just had the ball all the time around the penalty area, and mostly we took bad shots. But we would occasionally get into a position to take a good shot, and then that shot would be missed or saved. I have this very specific memory of one of the first games of the year. Paulinho, in like the 89th minute, had a tap-in on the goal line and managed to like pop it right into the keeper's chest. Like, there were a whole bunch of games where we would have won with just like, you know, a perfectly normal finish on a good chance, even leaving aside all of the shots we were taking from bad areas, and our defense was totally working. And I because like the way that VS Boas fell apart, as I understand it, is that like once things were going badly, his like complete lack of man management skills meant that he lost the clubhouse and things fell apart, and he started trying to do weird things to save it that just made everything worse. And like, eventually it was always going to spiral because he didn't have those man management skills. But so long as things were going well, if our finishing had been just average, it could have lasted for a lot longer. And I don't know if that's like good or bad. Like, in some ways there was an inevitable end to it, but the fact that the inevitable end happened there, I think, is in great part a function of a pretty random finishing slump.
Well, Michael, so I want to talk.
I mean, remember Soldado had like a historic case of the yips in front of goal.
Oh, everyone did.
Many times, and we're like, we put him clean through, and then what the fuck are you doing, Roberto?
So, Michael, I want to talk about that collapse.
Was it that year that, like, he dribbled the ball into the Fiorentina keeper, or was that the next year?
That was the next year.
Anyway.
That was I was there for that one actually. Also there for the two-footed tackle he put on in our own penalty box to concede a penalty. That was Jesus Christ. So I want to talk about that because my memory of sort of what happened is we're misfiring, our offense isn't producing, and the tension starts to get ratcheted up around the club. And I think some of that is just the, you know, English media narrative bullshit. And I think some of that, like you said, Michael, was the just complete inability of AVB to sort of run with man management, at least across the squad. And as a result of that, like you said, he started tinkering, and as a result of that, our defense fell apart. Can you walk us through just the defense just disintegrating that year? And it really culminates with that Liverpool game. It was really the City game immediately followed by the Liverpool game where we just got waxed. And
the other important thing that happened that season, I think it's worth noting, is while we bought the Beatles, we didn't buy a fullback. And so we had Danny Rose was our only fullback, our only left back.
Who we later learned apparently had never gotten one-on-one coaching on how to be a left back.
Yeah. So Rose gets hurt, and we immediately move Vertonghen out to the left where he gets hurt. And then we've got this like makeshift center back line that's like barely able to produce. And then we have some injuries in midfield, and so now suddenly we're pressing up the field without the kind of defenders to make to sort of strangle teams, and we're taking more risks in the attack, and we have a second choice back line, and we just got destroyed by clubs, and like it just every tweak that he made it worse, and it also seemed that every attempt he made to get the players back on track made it worse, because again, by all accounts, he's just really awful at getting players to like him and do what he wants unless they're already happy. And so once they were sad, his decisions got worse, the players got worse, and we can see like how many times Liverpool just passed it right through us in that game.
I don't think I have ever been as mad at a sports team I follow as that Liverpool game. Like, I have watched some frustrating games in high leverage situations with with the Orioles, who I support in baseball, like playoff games and just shitty games where they're out of contention and getting their asses kicked. I have seen a lot of like bad games from like my football team, from other Spurs games. I don't think I've ever been as angry at a team I followed as I was during that Liverpool game, because it felt like the players gave up. It felt like AVB didn't know what he was doing. It felt like AVB didn't care. I mean, that game felt like we say capitulation a lot. I don't think any other game I've watched feels like as much of a capitulation as that Liverpool game. And that's right on the heels of us getting our ass kicked by City.
Our lineup that game, our back line was Kyle Walker at right back. Okay. Michael Dawson at center back. Okay. Kapu at center back. And Kyle Naughton at left back, and he got yanked at halftime for Zeki Friars.
Zeki Friars.
That's just bleak. We had a midfield of Sandro, Dembele, and Paulinho. Sandro got hurt in the 30th minute and had to go off for Holtby. Paulinho got a red card at some point. Like, it was just a fucking clusterfuck of terrible.
It was really extremely bad, and I think sometimes clubs overreact by firing a manager in midseason. I don't know what else they could have done after that game.
I mean, we could have just not appointed Tim Sherwood.
We'll get into Tim Sherwood in a second, because there's that element to it. But just, I mean, Brian, what was your memory of that performance? Was it, overreacting? Am I looking at it through like the lens of hindsight?
No, it was bad. And, I mean, you know, coming so closely after the 6-0 to City, which had been, you know, less than a month before. And, you know, it was and it had been preceded by two games that we won against a bad Fulham and a bad Sunderland team, but where we had decidedly looked shitty. Like, Fulham, my recollection of the Fulham match is that Fulham cut us apart with through balls through the back line, and it was only through, you know, them being not as good finishers and, you know, some finishing luck on our part that we got that win. And the Sunderland match, like this was another horrible Sunderland team. And, you know, we barely squeaked that one, too. And so it was just like, wow, like, this is kind of the run that we're on. And then, and like Ben said, you know, capitulation was the exact right word for what happened at Liverpool. And it just... Whatever. Whatever one of you said.
The order of events is we were 1-0 down, and then Sandro got hurt. And then we were 2-0 down at halftime. And then we were 2-0 down until the 63rd minute when Paulinho got a red card. And then I mean, it was also, it was really bad before it really blew up. But
we were lucky to not lose by more than five.
Right. After that red card, it was just like, we gave up. We had nothing.
And in my recollection of AVB during that match was someone who was just sitting on the sideline on the bench at White Hart Lane and just who looked absolutely 100% bereft. Like he had no idea what he could do, what would change it up. Like, you know, I mean, he used two subs early in the match, and then like his one game changing thing was to bring on Townsend shortly before Paulinho gets that red card. And it's like, all right, well, now what?
Townsend for Dembele. It's like, we just had nothing in midfield.
Yeah, let's control this match.
We lost Sandro, Paulinho, and Dembele out of our midfield, and we're left with Lewis holding down the fort.
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, like, you could forgive him if we had lost that game, you know, 2-0, 3-0, whatever. And it's like, all right, look, hey, injuries, the red card. It was a, you know, a bad thing happened. There was a confluence of events, like whatever. But you know, this is kind of, you know, the type of stuff that I know Greg hates, but, you know, the body language of the players.
No, for once, I think that's totally legitimate. Like, it all, like, we're not trying to read tea leaves here. We know, like, it's all of a piece. We know what happened. We could see it. And these guys gave up on him. And there's few games, like I said, there's not many games where I can say that it was actually a capitulation.
And I mean, you're talking about, like, some of the players that were on the field for that game. You're talking about Hugo Lloris, Kyle Walker, Michael Dawson, Aaron Lennon. They are players who, you know, throughout their Spurs career, always, always, always played as hard as they could. They play, you know, they have a certain loyalty. They have a certain respect within the club. And that game was just, it really did break the spirits of so many of those guys. I have a distinct memory of Michael Dawson walking off of that field with his head down, just not looking up at the fans, not making eye contact with the bench, just being so over that season and that managerial reign.
I mean, there are people who felt like the Tim Sherwood experience after it was an upgrade over this. I mean, Sherwood, I think everyone was ready to see him go, but I think it speaks to how bad it got at the end of that year with AVB that, you know, and a lot of what we felt good about after AVB left was, oh, Harry Kane's getting minutes, Nabil Bentaleb's playing well, you know, these younger guys were at least getting time. But I think, like, that Liverpool game is just the sort of end point of a lot of poor decision-making that year from AVB. We talked about Hugo Lloris not playing, or at least not playing for, like you said, Brian, it was like 3 weeks or something where he had to like fight with Brad Friedel for a starting role. It's insane. We bought the French number one and we're not going to use him. Christian Eriksen started five games before AVB got sacked. Lamela started two. Now, I think Lamela was hurt, but still, two games. Chadley barely played either. I mean, these are all productive players that AVB was choosing not to use. And I don't know why. Like, I don't know if this was some power play bullshit or he didn't think they were ready, but I think it speaks to some poor decision making or at least some lack of harmony within the organization. But it characterizes that second year under AVB, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, he persisted with running out Soldado. Like, the one player that he had faith in was Soldado. And it was just like, he consistently did not produce, and it's like, all right, well, we've got Adebayor on the bench, like, and you know, that was something that Tim Sherwood did, was when he came in, was he restored Adebayor to the starting lineup, and we became better. And it's just like, you know, like it was just, it was It was AVB just had this idea of this is what his team was and this is what it looked like. And it didn't include these guys that had been bought for him by Daniel Levy, by Franco Baldini. And he wasn't going to include them. Erickson just wasn't going to make it in. Lamella just wasn't going to make it in. Chadley wasn't going to make it in. And we can talk about in hindsight, like, maybe it was fine they didn't play Chadley, or, you know, that he ignored Kirakesh or whatever, or that, you know, Eric Lamella played a limited amount of minutes. Like, okay, fine, we can talk about that. But, like, he had options and he just didn't ever explore
them. I mean, there's a pattern there. I mean, you can see it. It's...
Well, it was funny. In preparing for this, like, I was, you know, trying to look for stuff about kind of the end of the AVB era. And Ted Knutson from StatsBomb, like, wrote this, like, basically recapped, like, if you guys remember Moneyball, the Brad Pitt movie. There's a scene in there where Brad Pitt goes in and he tells the manager of his baseball team that, you know, he can't play this certain player because he sold all these other guys. And, like, and Knutson basically recaps that scene, but with Daniel Levy and AVB as though, well, you can't play Andros Townsend. I've loaned him to QPR. And you have to play Lamella now. And, you know, and that was what it felt like, is that Levy and Baldini had assembled this team, had given AVB these players, and AVB was like, nah, screw you. I'm going to play the way I want to play.
And, lest we all forget, just for context, while this is all going on, as things start to fall apart on AVB, Tim Sherwood's in the background politicking, whispering in Daniel Levy's ear and stabbing AVB in the back. Which, I don't know how the hell that happened. I mean, whatever you think about AVB's tenure, Tim Sherwood should not have been, you know, engaging in court in palace intrigue at Spurs. Which is weird, because Spurs generally aren't a club with a lot of this kind of palace intrigue, or at least we don't get to see it. And it was very public in this case. Sherwood was definitely leaking stuff to papers, and he got his shot. But it was really bad. It was really, really bad. You know, you could just see it fraying around the edges at the end of his tenure. All his performative stuff wasn't washing in the same way. It was just, I don't know. I liked AVB a lot. I was very enthusiastic about AVB in that first year. And just that second year, man, I don't think I've ever turned on anyone quite as quick as I did with AVB. I mean, Ben, what's your, you sort of look back at the totality of the Andre Villas-Boas experience. Like, what's your sort of takeaways from it? Like, what do you think of when you think of the AVB era at Spurs?
What I think of is, do you remember that YouTube video set to Imagine Dragons Radioactive
about
AVB's first year, where, like, you know,
remember those when those videos were a thing?
Things aren't going well, and then
we're about to take
boom,
a huge step.
Everything turns around. What a hero! I mean, I just. Like, I loved AVB so much when he showed up. And you loved him more than I did, Greg.
Well, because there were all those other fans and journalists
who were... betrayed you.
Yeah.
A lover scorned.
I really am. But there were so many... Because I think it's easy to forget. There were so many people skeptical of him when he came into Spurs, both in the media and sort of, like, other teams' fans, especially Chelsea fans. So there was this sort of, like, you know, defensive mentality around some of that, especially when things were... sort of going well that first year, and it was very easy to get sort of wrapped up in that. And he was the first manager Spurs had hired, like, while I was a fan. And I don't know, like, you're right, I got just that last month of his tenure just made me so angry about him. It's oof. I just, the whole thing got poisoned for me. But
I think the one thing that has been a lingering result of AVB is, I, as much as I loved Pochettino at Southampton and wanted him to be Spurs manager, I was very, very reluctant to allow myself to feel attached to him because of how much of a letdown AVB ended up being. To the point where I think everybody thinks I hate Mauricio Pochettino.
But yeah, why would we think that, Ben?
That seems weird.
But I have always felt guarded about, you know, especially after that first season when, like, you know, he wasn't fixing the obvious mistakes of the Bentaleb-Mason midfield, and you know, we didn't sign a defensive midfielder that next summer. You know, I was just very...
Well, you felt like a very Martin Jol hire. You felt like a very Martin Jol.
Yeah. But, like, and, you know, even when things started going well, I was still, like, wouldn't allow my, you know, myself to give my heart away cheaply, you know, because I didn't want to be hurt again. And, you know, and then since then, I've always been sort of been waiting for him to leave or something bad to happen. And a lot of that is AVB's fault.
Michael, what do you think of when you think of AVB? Like, when you look back in anger or not, what comes to mind when you think about that era of Tottenham?
Yeah, I mean, I mostly have good memories of that era of Tottenham. There were so many good games. There was so that United game, the City game, like, you know, that streak sometime, it was from like October to December when Sandro was fit with Dembele and we were just like completely untouchable, you know. And then, you know, I mean, that's the thing with AVB, my sort of story of AVB that I've got in my head is that, like, he's a good manager. He's just like not good at the fundamental thing that you have to motivate a bunch of people who are very hard to get to listen to and motivate. And so long as things were going well, his ideas were good, would win soccer games. Maybe they weren't as exciting as you'd want, but there was just this, we didn't know it. We thought that he was like dreamy and wonderful, and the players must think he was dreamy and wonderful. But there was this sort of Damocles over the team that the moment things went bad, it was all going to fall apart. And it was just, and when that was going to happen, you know, there's a lot of sort of randomness that goes into it. But the moment things went wrong, it was going to fall apart. And I just prefer to remember, like, the good stuff before that, because it was fun. And AVB was he was a good tactical manager. He wasn't as exciting as we may have wanted him to be, but he absolutely made that team good. He just had no capacity to fix the clubhouse once it started going wrong. And that's the other thing that I think is the important legacy of AVB, is that, like, it took Pochettino. I mean, obviously, and you know, obviously Tim Sherwood holds a lot of responsibility for this, but like the clubhouse falling apart under AVB and then getting, like, you know, made, you know, whatever Sherwood did to it beyond that, it took Pochettino a year to like clean all of that out.
He literally exiled players, One of which is a guy who, you know, I don't want to say club legend because that's a little too strong for Kabul, but very well liked, very long tenured, and he.
Yeah, there's a whole Kabul.
And Lennon, like a full on.
Yeah, Lennon, another one. I forgot about Lennon. Oof.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because you think about that goal against West Ham, which is a very iconic Gareth Bale moment. But that whole like sideline hug thing felt very just like, God, we're gonna be watching that for years. And now when you see that goal, it sort of like cuts out right as the hugs all start. And, you know, you just sort of focus on the goal and, of course, Tom Carroll's assist. But, oh, yeah, I don't know. I just sort of like compartmentalize AVB versus, like, I just don't think of AVB when I think of the moments from his tenure.
I think, remember, Gareth Bale gave his daughter AVB's initials.
That's wild.
And I don't think that's an accident.
No, I don't think so either. This is why he's never coming back to Spurs, guys. Like, he still resents how we treated him.
You know, I came into, like, we decided we were going to do this, and I came into this thinking, like, you know, this, my preconceived, you know, recollection, if that's a thing, a preconceived recollection, but my remembrance of the AVB era is that it was much more transformative than maybe in hindsight it was. Because I felt like – I feel like, you know, Harry Redknapp really put us over the hump in terms of pushing us from mid-table to now we're in the Champions League, we are finishing top four. And in my mind, Villas-Boas changed that in that he did the same thing, but he also made us into a more kind of continental, less kind of old-school English type of squad. And then I guess looking back at it, it was really kind of a step backwards, or maybe just sort of a continuation of the same sort of performance level that Redknapp had us at. But I really do think that AVB sets a lot of the groundwork that allows the Pochettino era Spurs to be what they are. And, you know, because of the players that were brought in, because of the changes of system, because of all the things that he did in his only year and a half in charge, I think, I think he's responsible
some
for
things
kind of
he
a
did.
Lot of
some,
where we are now.
Some things that happened while he was here. I think a lot of his player acquisitions weren't really him. But I think it's certainly a lot of the Spurs we watch now, both in terms of who we bought and in terms of sort of the markers the club laid down when AVB was here. I mean, it certainly was a I think it was a big transition point. It just wasn't immediate, and I guess the way we all thought it would be.
Yeah.
But yeah, are there any final thoughts on AVB? We have a little bit. I know we've gone on very long tonight, but we have a little bit to talk about in current day Spurs. Any final thoughts on AVB?
He's very pretty.
He is very pretty. Is he our prettiest manager?
I don't know. Harry Redknapp has those beautiful jowls.
He does.
One thing about AVB's beauty that we haven't talked about was that gravelly voice, which was like, I loved it.
Very good beard, too. He did a very good job with his beard.
He did.
And it was weird because he was kind of a ginger. But yeah, it was
just ginger enough.
Yep.
So yeah, we have one or two current day things to talk about. Spurs open their new stadium next week. We are not match going fans, or at least not regular match going fans. Ben, are you excited about this?
I'm so excited. You know, we had the test event this weekend that everybody you'd follow on Twitter and social media went to, it sounds like. And all of the, you know, the pictures, all of the videos, you know, you can hear, you know, even a half empty stadium.
It was loud.
So loud. You know, when the Spurs rang around the stadium for the first time, it was just like, you know, tingly. I would have been very, very, very jealous to have been there. But yeah, I think it's going to be awesome to see next week against Crystal Palace. Spurs finally have a home.
I think one of the things that excited me most about watching, other than the stuff you talked about, Ben, which I agree with, is, and maybe this is like fan bullshit, part like tribal bullshit in me speaking, but what I was really happy with was how distinctive the stadium looked, and how, like, it looked very good, don't get me wrong, but compared to like the Emirates, which is just sort of like a, you know, a loaf of white bread, it's sort of there. And I don't know, maybe that's just like the Spurs fan in me talking, but it just looked so radically different from the way the girders looked, to the layout of the cop, to the like cockerel sort of hanging above the stadium. It just looked distinctive and cool. And I don't know, I feel like so many modern stadiums, especially in soccer, are so bland, at least on the inside, that I was very happy with how distinctive everything looked, and that it looked distinctive in a good way. Does anyone else have stadium thoughts? It's just, other than it's just nice to be out of Wembley.
I mean, I'm just happy that we don't have to hear about how we're never going to move into that stadium ever. Like, now
there's
no
still
one...
time for this to fall apart.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. That's why we bring you back.
Yeah, if I never have to hear another presenter talk about how, you know, the stadium move really derailed the season, and you know, we didn't do this, that, and the other, and you know, how
the Wembley curse.
Yeah, if I never have to hear about that again, that'd be great.
So
the thing is that at the end of the season, we have these two difficult games away to the title contenders, and five home games, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, again, all winnable. So, like, no matter what happens, almost certainly the narrative of the end of the season is going to be about Spurs getting a new stadium bounce or Spurs not doing well enough in their new stadium. In either way, the new stadium is going to be the thing that people talk about that sort of defines this season.
If we qualify for the Champions League and, like, Arsenal fans are really mad about how we got to play our final games in the new stadium, that would make me extremely happy. That would be the best possible. Well, the best possible way we win the Champions League, but you know, that would be fun too. So yeah, let's talk about the Champions League. So some of our first matches in the new stadium will be in the Champions League. Unfortunately, they're going to be against Man City. I'm more disappointed because you're going to draw a hard team at this stage, although it would have been nice to have Porto. I'm mostly disappointed. I always think it's a bit of a bummer to play teams from your own country in the Champions League because, especially as relatively new club to the Champions League, I think one of the cool things about it is like, ooh, we get to play Dortmund or, ooh, we get to play Real Madrid. They're like, you get to see all these cool teams from the continent. And, you know, I mean, City's a really good team, but we play them all the time. In fact, we're going to play them like 3 times in the next 2 weeks or some shit like that.
Wait, I want to start with this. Because
yeah, go for it,
I
Brian.
Told you so. Because we were on the last
you did.
Podcast,
you did.
Greg was like, oh, you know what would be so Spurs is if we drew Porto and lost. I was like, no, you know what would be Spurs? It's if we draw City or Liverpool and just get absolutely wrecked. So here we go, guys. We get Manchester City. We get to play them 3 times. And, you know, like Greg said, 2 weeks, it's going to be like we're in La Liga and it's Clasico just over and over again for an entire fucking season. And, you know, what? It's the second game at the new stadium is the Champions League game against City. Cool. And, you know, maybe we'll get a good result. Maybe it'll be 2-1 in favor of us. And then we'll go to Manchester City Stadium and we'll lose 6-0. And it'll be embarrassing and it'll be sad. And it's going to be, you know, this is the worst possible outcome. I would so much rather lose to...
I would rather lose to City than Liverpool. Like, so it's not the worst outcome
for
me.
All right. It is like the 99th percentile for the worst thing that could happen to us. I mean, you know, like, I would have rather Porto. I would have rather Ajax. I would have rather Juventus. It's just like
Barcelona. Even like that wouldn't. We probably won't beat them, but at least it's different.
Yeah. No. But I mean, the way that
you played Barcelona this season.
Yeah. Fair enough.
The way that the draw is set up, though, if we beat Manchester City, maybe we can make the finals.
That's true. Ben, do you think we have a shot against City?
I mean, we definitely have a shot. We're not going to win, but we definitely have a shot.
I mean, yeah, because we will be at the games. Like, we will be playing in them, so theoretically.
Michael, should Spurs be... Like we said, we play 3 games against City in a relatively short amount of time. Should we be prioritizing our league match?
Yeah, I mean, it depends a lot on, like, what our squad looks like and whether we have players for it or not, because like we're probably gonna lose all of those games. It kind of doesn't matter that much which ones we have the very best players in. I don't know. I mean, we should prioritize the league match probably, and we'll have a better idea then. But
if
I don't think
there's Liverpool this weekend. It definitely changes that calculus for me.
Yes.
If we what against Liverpool, Ben? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
If we beat Liverpool, then I'm less concerned. Like, if we win our 5 home games and lose to Man City and beat Liverpool, like, we're fine.
Okay.
But if we get our asses kicked by Liverpool, you know, getting a point against Man City in the league might prove crucial for our top 4 hopes. And, you know.
What we're going to do, though, is just play all our good players in all of the games and hope they don't die. I mean, well, I don't think we're going to make that much of a...
I mean, not all of our good players, because prioritization for Spurs really just means which fullbacks are playing.
Jesus, you're right.
So,
you know,
it's just like, which fullbacks do we want to play against Manchester City in the Champions League? Do we want the fast ones that won't get totally roasted, or do we want the other ones that are bad?
But our fullback rotation is basically... I have rarely been able to see like a logic to our fullback rotation. I think we just sort of roll out the ones that didn't start the last one.
I mean, these days that's definitely true. Let's talk about the Liverpool match. We have that coming up this weekend. We are at Anfield. I don't know. We've been off so long. I thought we were off for about 2 weeks, a few weeks ago, and I thought that was going to do us a world of good. And we went from playing really well to playing like garbage. So, I don't know. Spurs have been off for approximately 5 years, so in theory we should have some guys who are fit. But I'm not feeling terribly optimistic about this game, but I am a notable, extremely negative person. Michael, are you more optimistic about our chances against Liverpool than I am?
Nope.
Okay.
Dyer missed the second England game for going off injured. Winks was injured at the end of the So it's not clear that we're going to be able to play a midfield.
Well, it's not. We are recording this on Wednesday night. We have literally no idea if Winks is healthy or injured, so we'll...
It's Thursday night, by the way.
Thursday. Oh, Jesus Christ. Cool. Yeah. Thursday night. Sorry.
Yeah, so we don't know. Maybe they'll be fit, today. But like, even if they are fit, Liverpool are much, much better than us, and they're at home. So we're not likely to win.
Well, hopefully Wanyama comes back to save us a point again, so...
Yeah, I mean, because we have really struggled. Like, it'll be interesting to see if Pochettino can figure out a way to pack it in properly against Liverpool, because there's no way that we can, like, control midfield against Liverpool.
Well, it's worth remembering it wasn't Liverpool, but we did sort of figure out a way to deal with City to some extent in our other match against them this year. So, I don't know, maybe we'll figure something out to do against Liverpool, but a lot of that's contingent on it not going wrong right away, so we'll see.
Yeah, I'm not optimistic.
I hate playing Liverpool.
Hopefully nobody plays a back pass to Sadio Mane inside our own box for him to score in the first minute. But
fucking Christ.
I wouldn't rule that out.
No, I wouldn't either. Well, we'll find out together. I know I am excited to see the new stadium, especially for the Champions League. It's very, very cool. Thank you guys for taking this trip down memory lane. We'll try to pick a happier topic next time. We'll probably be doing a lot of it over the summer. So if you have suggestions, please tweet them at us. Or, I don't know, angrily yell at Dustin about it in the comments section. Ben, you have any final thoughts or places you want people to find you on the internet?
You can find my immense dimension on Twitter at Comrade U Spurs.
Brian, where can people find you on the tubes?
You can find me on Twitter at Brian_Ashlock. That is Brian with a Y.
There you go. Michael, not that you need it, but where can people find you imitating me online?
Yeah, so you can subscribe to Double Pivot, and you can follow me online at Brett Rainbow.
There you go. Michael, thanks for joining us. It's always nice to have you back, Michael. Thank you for making the time for us tonight.
Fantastic.
All right, and I am, of course, your host, Greg. You can find me on Twitter.com at skipjack0079. You can find me on LinkedIn at Brett Rainbow. And we is always us, no matter what social media account you follow. For Michael, for Ben, for Brian, for Rob, who is dearly departed tonight, unfortunately, and for, of course, Brett Rainbow, I'm your host, Greg. Come on, you Spurs.